Going into hour three with Gary Patterson, I should say hour three with our Gary Patterson, and also with Bill Harry, the founder of the Mersey Beat magazine, as well as a prolific writer of Beatles books and a Beatles insider from the very beginning, friend of John Lennon. Just getting to a couple of these interesting stories, and I want to ask more, too, about his work with Pink Floyd and Led Zeppelin, and some of the other mystical occurrences that have been associated with the Beatles and with other bands, next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett, talking with Gary and Harry, Gary Patterson and Bill Harry. And Bill Harry was just talking about answering Gary Patterson's question about the sound system at the Liverpool College of Art that, pre-Beatles, but still John Lennon, Paul McCartney, and George Harrison, and Stuart Sutcliffe, and Pete Best?
Yeah, Pete wasn't with them at the time, no. Incidentally, you can tell, Ted, that the Italian restaurant was called La Dolce Vita. And we went to, Virginia and I went to another Italian restaurant with Sonny and Cher, but Cher knew how to eat her Italian food, and she didn't put her hands in the bowl.
How old was Cher when you went to dinner with Sonny and Cher?
Well, this was on the first trip to England, and she was very young. She looked
18.
They had the most marvelous clothes on. I mean, they were fantastic. They dressed like that all the time. They looked really great.
This PA system you were talking about, that they talked the school into buying a PA system for them because they were going to be the official Liverpool College Art Band.
Well, what happened? We used to have dances in the college basement, and it was usually the big influence at the time was traditional jazz, and they used to have book a jazz band called the Mersey Zippy. And Stuart and I were on the Students' Union Committee. That means we were on the committee, and we could decide on how to organise the dances and all kinds of other student activities. And the lads said they had no money for any PA equipment or anything like that. And so Stuart and I proposed and seconded that we use Students' Union funds to pay for a PA system for the college, which they could use as the college band. So they we got the PA system, and of course they took it with them. It disappeared. It never came back to the school, you know. And remember one time when the Beatles did their very first radio show in Manchester, we got a coach outside the college, and they had the local fan club people, and Brian Epstein, Paul McCartney's dad, the Beatles, ourselves there and everything. And so we went on this coach trip to Manchester for the first record show. And on the bus was a spy. The Students' Union had sent this member of the union purporting to be a Beatles fan, but his job was to find out what happened to the PA equipment. And so he made the mistake of asking John Lennon, and he got quite a mouthful off John. But sadly, when Stuart wanted to come back to Liverpool and take an ATD course at the college, that was an art training, art teacher's diploma. So he left Hamburg and came to Liverpool again and went to the art college for an appointment to see about him going on the course. But they turned him down for the course, so he went back to Hamburg, and it said that they turned him down because they still hadn't got the PA equipment back. And then when the Beatles started to become famous sort of locally after Brian Epstein took over the management, he phoned Fred O'Brien, who was in charge of the students' union at the time, and says, look, the Beatles, for old time's sake, they'd like to come and do another college dance for you, and they'd do it for just a peppercorn figure of £5. And Fred said, we're not having them here. They didn't return our PA equipment.
Oh, God. and how big, they were on the rise, but they weren't the Beatles that the Beatles became yet.
Oh, no. No, this
okay.
was, they were doing the big thing locally. They were the number one group in Liverpool by that time.
Okay. Talk about a little bit more about the night that you were there when John and Stuart came up with the Beatles.
Yes, this was This was at the Gambia Terrace flat, and sort of we were there, and there was a guy called Royston Ellis, who was a poet, you know, and he was chatting, and he took out a Vic inhaler, and he opened it, and there was like this strip of Benzedrine in, and he says, if you chew this Benzedrine from a Vic inhaler, keep you awake all night. You know, that was the first time that he'd ever come across such a thing as a drug, you know, apart from half a pint of bitter. And so it's sitting talk, and they were still trying to figure out the what to call themselves. You know, this was about, you know, January, February 1960, and they still hadn't come up with a name. And Stuart was saying, well, you know, we've been doing a lot of Buddy Holly numbers. Why not get a name like that of Buddy Holly's backing group, the Crickets? So we think crickets, yeah. So the thing is, we should think of an insect, you know. So they started, which insects are there? And they thought of beetles. And they were talking about beetles. And he said, that sounds a sort of good name. But they did all variations. They did beetles, B-E-A-T-L-E-S. They did just beetles with the two E's. Then they did the silver beets. So they used these variations right until August of 1960 when they finally decided to call themselves the Beatles, you know?
That story had always been told. I thought it came to John Lennon in a dream. Is that not true?
No, that's what he wrote in Merseybeat in the first issue, the piece that I got him to write for me. When he said a man came down on a flaming pie and said, you are Beatles with an A, you know. And he said it came to him in a vision. That was in the piece he wrote for me in Merseybeat.
And yet you, after the Beatles, you went on to work with Led Zeppelin and Pink Floyd. But you didn't know those guys quite in the same way that you knew the Beatles.
Oh, no. Because when I went to sort of London, it was absolutely manic. I mean, Virginia and I were out seven nights a week. We went to every single sort of concert there was, every single television show. We were involved with all the bands. I mean, initially I was writing for about five of the music papers at the same time and interviewing everybody. I mean, and they arranged for me to be the only person in England who was allowed to interview Bobby Darin, because when he came over, he wouldn't do any interviews, but it was arranged that I could interview him. So I went to the Claridge's Hotel and did this interview with him. And I, when it was published, I got a call from Tommy, his PA, who said, Bobby wants you to come and meet him at the Claridge's, because he says he's read the article and it's the best article that's ever been written about him. So I went to sort of Claridge's and we sat and chatting and everything like that, because the article I'd done on Bobby was all about his philosophy and his thoughts about life. And nothing about the usual questions that journalists ask, you know. Yeah. And I was interested in just sort of all the strange things that happen to people and the philosophy of life of people and what they think of life after death and all this sort of thing, which Bobby was quite interested in. And I showed him this song I'd been writing, or a poem called The Green Fields of Earth. The green fields of earth, where do they lie in history books and things like that. You know, it was a thing about, you know, the future when the whole earth was like a concrete mass, you know, and no place for the animals to roam and everything. And he was interested in that. And he actually helped me to write some of the verses and things, you know. But, you know, it was all a complete involvement of everything that was happening in the music scene at the time. And
that sounds very exciting.
Pardon?
That sounds very exciting.
Yeah. Apart from writing about the all the artists I was interviewing for the music papers, you know, everyone from Paul Simon onwards, I was asked to take over publicity of the Kinks and the Hollies. And then from then onwards, it went on, and everyone, you know, 10 years after, Jethro Tull, David Bowie, Free, you know, it just went on for 18 years, you know, till I got fed up of it and decided to junk it all.
Gary, you had a question in there?
Well, you know, just to be involved with Pink Floyd and the Beatles in 1967, I mean, if you could be a fly on the wall, I would like to be at Abbey Road Studios and room in Studio 2 and Studio 3 when the Beatles were cutting Sgt. Pepper's and Pink Floyd was cutting Piper at the Gates of Dawn, you know, at the same time. You know that the psychedelic period. I mean, the ideas flowing back and forth in that one studio would have been incredible. So, Bill, were you involved with Pink Floyd at that time in 67?
No, I was involved with them at a bit of an early stage when the managers asked me to sort of take over the sort of publicity in that. And I thought they were interested in sort of all kinds of sounds. So I thought, well, an obvious place to take them was the Radiophonics Workshop in Maida Vale in London. And what this was, the BBC got this special outfit which was experimenting in all different sounds. And they did like the music for the Doctor Who science fiction television series and things like that. So I took the Pink Floyd along. And they were showing them all the amazing things that could be done with sounds. For instance, they had a dripping tap, and they used all the electronics to make all these fantastic sounds that you could make just out of a dripping tap. And, you know, they were completely fascinated, and they took them all around, experimenting with all the different sounds, you know. Well, that's the main memory I have of them. And, of course, the other main thing that used to happen in London at the time was the inn clubs. There used to be clubs where all the musicians used to go. And it wasn't like today where people are hounded by paparazzi or anything like that. At the clubs, they were able to go, enjoy themselves, and they weren't hounded by people, you know. And it was like the Scots of St. James was... Well, the first one we started to go through, you know, I remember one night me and Virginia were there. There was the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, Marlon Brando, and James Baldwin, the author. And I was fascinated by him, so I went over and I was chatting with James Baldwin. It was a fantastic, you know, person to be able to sort of speak to, one of my heroes and that. But it was the whole of the club life there, the Revolution Club, the Speakeasy Club, and the bizarre things that used to happen. I mean, like, I remember one time when we were at the Revolution Club, because I did publicity for all these clubs as well, Revolution, Speakeasy and that. So I was at the Revolution Club, and I got they said, there's a call for you. And it was John Bonham calling me, and he said, I want to come down for a drink. And I said, where are you? He said, I'm in Birmingham. I said, well, you know, you're in Birmingham. I said, the bar shuts here at 2 o'clock. There's no point. You never get down here from Birmingham. He said, I'm coming. And the thing is, about 5 to 2, John Bonham arrives, and I said, you're a bit late. They'll be closing the bar in a minute. So he ordered us 50 bottles of lager.
And, you know? And just kept the party going.
Oh, we managed to drink them, yes. Yeah. And then it was off to the Playboy Club around the corner, where we always went after the Revolution, because you can get a nice big dinner for a nice breakfast of steak and chips for 50 pence, you know? We sit down, you know, with Telly Savalas and people like that were there, you know, and Tim Rice, he had a room up there in the Playboy Club. Tim Rice, you know, it was a great time.
Yeah. Now, as you knew Led Zeppelin then early on. Is there any truth to the story that it's Paul McCartney who's credited with naming Led Zeppelin?
No, I've not heard that.
You've never heard that story?
No.
I heard that this is how it was related to me, and I think I've seen it. Maybe Gary knows. Gary, you know what I'm talking about?
Well, actually, I believe that Bill would say it was, it was the Who. Because after the Yardbirds had broken up, Jimmy Page was putting a band together. I think Entwistle was interested, and, of course, Keith Moon. And I believe it was Keith Moon who said, you know, if we had a band, it would go over like a Led Zeppelin.
Okay, that's it?
And the thing is, Keith, Keith came in when the Beatles were sitting round, and, you know, he says, you know, I'd like to join you. And Paul said, you have to drag up a seat and have a drink. He said, no, I'd like to join you. And Ringo said, well, we've got a drummer, thanks.
Well, that's what I had heard the same story, but it was Paul McCartney, and it was at a cocktail party or some get-together, and he was the one who said, well, that'll go over like a Led Zeppelin. And that was the version. But you're saying it's verified then? It's Keith Moon who said that?
Yes. Uh-huh. I mean, that's the back to the history part, because the Yardbirds were breaking up. Jimmy Page wanted to put a group together. If you remember Robert Plant and Bonham, they were basically unknown. They were, what, 18, 19 years old at the time, and the Who was going through some stages, and they decided maybe they could put something together, but then Moon said, well, we'd go over like a Led Zeppelin. So Jimmy Page remembered that line, and that's how the band came about.
Yeah, because they were the new Yardbirds when I first became involved with them. And actually, they asked another artist I represented was called Terry Reid. And they asked him, Jimmy Page asked him, they wanted him to be the lead singer with Led Zeppelin. But he turned them down, and it was him who recommended Robert.
Were you familiar with Peter Green?
Yes. Yes, Peter Green, Fleetwood Mac.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
It was really, I read this, I think it was the Mick Fleetwood autobiography in which he was talking about how revered Peter Green, the founder of Fleetwood Mac, was, and that he was considered a guitarist above a level, above anybody in town, and that it was originally that, whereas nowadays, you know, people would have written Eric Clapton is God or something and spray painted that on a wall, that before Eric Clapton, it was Peter Green. Is that true?
Well, Peter Green and a number of others, yes. There were some absolutely brilliant guitarists around at the time, and some didn't emerge sort of as big, you know. But there were many guitarists equally as good, if not better, than Eric Clapton, of course.
Yeah, but and then he had mental issues, didn't he, after that?
He did. And it, like Sid Barrett and like a number of people who sort of couldn't cope. There's a lot of people who could never cope with the fame, and they ruined their own careers and got burned out or went round the bend, you know. They just couldn't cope because it was a time when, you know, there's so much pressure. So many groups and artists were manipulated or had them all the money taken away and didn't earn the money that that should have been theirs, that there was a lot of drugs involved and all the rest of it. It was just manic times, as I said, and a lot of people had to get off the bus.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned Sid Barrett there quickly of the early Pink Floyd founding member, the guy who was... Really, he was the leader of Pink Floyd and the guy about whom Shine On, You Crazy Diamond was written, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, coming up here, I want to ask you a little bit about, and I don't think we'll get it all in, but I want to ask you, where were you the night that John Lennon was shot?
Well, I was home and fast asleep, and the phone rang, and it was Henry Henroyd, a friend of mine in the Beatles, who'd seen John in New York a couple of months earlier and told me that John wanted to go back on the road and was going to come back to Liverpool and make appearances there. And he phoned me and he said, John had been shot. And I was horrified, you see. But there was no information, and I was just hoping it wasn't fatal or anything. And then I started getting all calls from the media after that, you know, for the whole of the day. And, you know, it was such a shock to find out that he was actually being killed. And, of course, you know, the phone never started. I had to take the phone off the hook, you know, because it was radio and TV. And I refused to see or speak to anyone. I came out in blotches. It was so horrific to realize that what had happened, you know.
Well, I want to pick it up there then, and I know it's a painful memory, and he's your friend, but I want to ask a little bit more about the night that John Lennon was shot, and also then some of the other aspects of the John Lennon murder, and then I want to go, Gary, I don't know where you want to end up with this, and I know we'll get to some phone calls coming up where everybody else can get involved in the conversation as well, but I think we've got a little bit more to get to on some of the more unusual aspects of the life of Bill Harry, who is the founder of Mersey Beat magazine, as well as a Beatles insider from the very beginning, and the guy who knows where all the bodies are buried. Oops, I believe I've revealed the theme of that question I'm getting to coming up next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Coming up in the next hour, we'll open up all of the calls, and I'll be curious to see where you go with this conversation. You can either continue talking with Bill Harry and have a Beatles question, or if you'd like, you can focus your question more to Gary Patterson, who is, of course, the historian of rock and roll mysteries on Coast to Coast AM. And Gary, I got a couple of those Already, I have some questions for you that people have asked about, and I'll pass those along to you, too.
Great.
So in that last hour, it may or may not be just about the Beatles, but I did get this one email, and before we get back to the stories, I just want to ask you what you think about this, both Gary and Bill Harry. This guy Brad from Louisiana emailed in and said, hey, if you're going to talk about boy bands, why don't you talk about boy bands of the last 30 years, something that, you know, somebody has heard of, that this the Beatles are ancient history. Why are the Beatles still important, Gary Patterson?
Well, the Beatles are important because if you listen to rock and roll before the Beatles, you know the answer. I mean, when the Beatles hit, I think on the chart you had Randy and the Rainbows doing Denise, which was a recycled version of doo-wop. And yeah, the recording technology the Beatles brought. But I have to say the Beatles were not a boys band, because a boy band stands there and they dance. They don't play their own instruments. The Beatles created a sound, they went into the studio, and their music changed the world. And any major rock act today will go back and they'll pay reverence to those early Beatle albums. And kids today, 11 years old, still know all the Beatle lyrics.
I you know, it's funny, I can't even think of a time when the Beatles ever danced. Bill Harry, did the Beatles ever dance, ever?
No, never on stage, you know. I mean, it's that nothing like sort of the boy bands became were just sort of guys who were generally manufactured, picked out, you know, by agents for their looks and the fact that they could just stand and dance and just sing, not play musical instruments and all the rest of it. It's a completely different thing. I mean, there's all kinds of sort of music and trends in music, whether it's punk, garage, R&B, whatever. There's all kinds of music, but as far as the Beatles, the longevity, they appeal to all ages, from kids onwards. I went to the Beatles convention in the States, and there were young kids of 14 and 50 going around with T-shirts with the picture of the Beatles and First Kids on the Block, you know?
Right.
And that's
right.
What they were, the First Kids on the Block. And the thing is, they appeal to young people and as well as all the different other generations.
My kids, I think one of my older son's favorite T-shirts is a Beatles knockoff T-shirt with Homer Simpson as John Lennon on the T-shirt. It's a great one. All right, hang on. We'll come back then. I want to pick up the story of the night John Lennon was murdered, and I want to ask about the conspiracy that has been alleged about that, both for Gary and Harry. And also, coming up, I'll ask about the Brian Jones story. And what does Bill Harry think about that allegation that Brian Jones was knocked off by the jealous Rolling Stones? Next on Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett. All right, so it is another great show of Rock and Roll Mysteries with Gary Patterson, and we're talking with Bill Harry, Beatles insider. The night that John Lennon was killed, you took your phone off the hook because you were getting a ton of calls. People want to get your reactions to it. So thanks for letting us ask you all these years later. What is your reaction to that? You would just accept that it's the one crazy killer, right?
Oh yes. I mean, Fenton Bressler, a British lawyer who died recently, he did the book The Murder of John Lennon, and he came up with all kinds of theories. It was CIA and all this math business. You know what I mean? To me, what was interesting was that everything around it all fell into the pattern of number nine. Now, John, throughout his entire life, was obsessed by the number nine. And every major event in his life and every major people he was involved with all had number nine. And even Yoko Ono, when you think she was known as Ocean Child, you know? But that night he was taken, and everything to do with his death had a number nine associated. Roosevelt Hotel, Roosevelt Hospital, where he was taken, had nine letters in it. And right from the beginning, being born in Liverpool, Liverpool has nine letters. And the area was born in, the house that he originally lived in, everything was connected with number nine. And in fact, when he died, and when I heard about it, though he was killed in New York on the 8th, it was actually nine. It was the 9th in Liverpool at the time he died. So at the place of his birth, he died on the 9th. Mm. And that number nine, it's amazing how it ran through his life from the time he was a baby right until the day he died.
No, it's very interesting. And so how did he play with numerology? I mean, was it something that he ever used?
He was always interested in everything like that. Now, he started when we were students together. He tried to get the whole point of Bad John was trying to discover the creativity. So he'd start with drink. Now, when you drink a lot, altered state of consciousness. Then he was doing these drugs in Hamburg, Preludin and Captagon. Then it was on to sort of LSD, smoking pot. Then it was the Maharishi. Then it was psychological thing with Janov, you know, at the primal scream and all that. Throughout his life, he was always seeking ways to you know, alter his mind, to get into altered states of consciousness, the whole thing, you know, because he thought this would put him in touch with some sort of creative source. And I can see that throughout his entire career.
Mm. I don't know, Gary, did you want to get in here on that?
Well, I mean, if you just think, John was born at 6:30 p.m. 6 plus 3 was 9. He was pronounced dead at 11:07. 7 plus 1 plus 1 is 9. But here's another thing. Bill Harry also has 9 letters. So, you know, that pulls it up. So that's kind of interesting, isn't it, Bill?
Yes, this 9. I mean, there's so many aspects to this that it is actually, I find, incredible. So one has to believe that there's something behind this sort of numerology. But, I mean, they were always interested in this sort of mystical type things. I mean, they even had the guy called Caleb in Apple, who was hired as their tarot card reader to advise them on things, you know. And he had similar things in the Dakota building, you know.
But considering what a mess Apple Corps turned out to be, though, did they get good advice from the other side?
No. Not okay. At all. I mean, they wouldn't take advice anywhere at the time because John, I think he exaggerated things. When he gave that interview and said they were nearly broke, he was written down to the last 75,000. That was absolutely ridiculous because the royalties that were coming in were really tremendous. The thing that was affecting them was the British tax system at the time, which was taking 95% of their income was going on tax. That's why George Harrison wrote the song Taxman, you know. They felt they were being robbed of their all their money. And that was the big thing. Not so much what was being lost at Apple was being lost to the British government. I mean, and even when he did the concert for Bangladesh as a charity thing to raise money for the starving kids in Bangladesh, the taxman insisted on the money, every penny of that charity money that was taxable they wanted. So George wrote them a check for £1 million.
I'll be darned. Gosh, it just seems criminal. And so, was it true then too that George also was interested in the numerology, or was that only a John thing?
No, it was John with George. He was the member of the Beatles who was stretched more than any other of them by the people he met, and he went intensely spiritual, you know, with all the Eastern gurus that he became involved with, and in meditation. For instance, he could do meditation up to 9 hours at a time, you know. He was very into that. Mm. And it's very strange, actually, when you think that the spirituality that radiates from the holy men and all the rest of that,
right.
And yet George went into wife swapping, drugs and all the rest of that, you know, and one would have thought that it would have taken, you know, the spiritualism would have taken them away from that kind of thing, but it didn't.
The wife swapping, was that the famous story about Eric Clapton and Patty Boyd?
And also sleeping with Ringo's wife.
Mm-hmm. What?
Maureen.
He slept with Maureen.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
And did Ringo sleep with Patty Boyd?
And he also slept with, what's his name's wife, Ronnie Wood's wife.
You know. Wow. But I mean, was it wife swapping, or was it just he was cheating on his friends with their wives?
Well, they with the Maureen, it was cheating. When they were sitting together down for dinner with Patty, George, and Ringo and Maureen, And George said right out while they were there that he was in love with Maureen. And Patty was horrified and ran into the loo, you know. But, you know, he did sleep with Maureen. And, like, with Ronnie Wood's wife, I think Ronnie Wood went off with Patty on holiday, and he went off with George went off with Ronnie's wife on holiday, you know.
Well, that's something I never knew about the Beatles. Is there anything about John Lennon, your experiences, your life with him, that you have never talked about publicly? Is there anything about the Beatles or John Lennon or any of the individual members of the Beatles that is yet to be discovered?
Oh, I think so. I think so. They're all, you see, the reason why is because of the complete mythology. Virtually the entire Beatles story is littered with falsities right from the very beginning, right from the day that, say, John Lennon was born. I mean, all the books have that John was born in the middle of an air raid. That started in Hunter Davis's book. And then somebody wrote, oh, it was the terrible air raid, you know, that happened that night. Then somebody else wrote, it was the biggest air wave of the war. Then people stood on the streets, and the whole city went up in flames and all that. And it got more and more exaggerated, you know. But the fact that there wasn't an air raid that night.
At all.
You know? And right the way through, as you go every step of the Beatles story, all these false myths have arisen. You know, and I want to do a book. The book I've been working on for years, which I want to do, is The Beatles Mythology, and to expose all these myths and the origins of the myths, because I've spent years tracing where the origins started, you know.
But it's not a myth that John Lennon was very affected by the fact that his father it was not there for him growing up, and then he turns around and he's not there for Julian.
Yes. And I suppose there are certain reasons sort of for that. Now, as far as the Alfred Lennon bit is concerned, it wasn't Alfred's fault. During the war, he was a merchant seaman, and you had to, in the war, you had to, you know, sail the Atlantic and do the things and do your duty, because otherwise you'd be called up and you'd be a soldier. So as a merchant seaman, you had no choice but to go to sea. So his father was naturally at sea, and there was all the incidents. Now, when he came back, you know, Julia was with other men. She always went with other men and everything like that. And so he came back, and she was pregnant to another man. And he and Alfred said he was willing to bring up the child himself as his own and that, but she wouldn't have anything to do with it. And Freddie wanted to be part of John's life, but was cut out. So it's not his fault, really. So, but and John had a really happy early life because he had all the aunties, the five Stanley sisters. Then there's all his cousins, you know, Stan and Lila, and all the rest of it. And they had tremendous times. He lived in a nice middle class area of Liverpool. He had his own gang. They had wonderful times. You know, they go swimming. They go to Blackpool. They'd see all the shows. He'd go to Scotland every holiday, you know. And he had a really, really good, interesting life, and far happier than the lives of many kids in Liverpool who lived in the poor areas of Liverpool, you know. I mean, all this thing about working class hero. He was the only member of the Beatles who was not working class.
No, I never knew that. It's very interesting. I think Brian Jones has come up a few times, Gary Patterson, when we've been talking about rock and roll mysteries, allegation that somehow Mick Jagger or other members of the Rolling Stones were nefariously involved in the death of Brian Jones. Can you set the table on that?
Well, basically, I like Brian. Now, but basically, we had good association with the Rolling Stones because I was sitting in the Philharmonic Hall in Liverpool for this beat group contest. And in front, the judges were Dick Rowe from Decca Records and George Harrison. I was sitting behind them, and George was chatting to Dick Rowe, and he said, "We've just been to London, and we've seen this great R&B group called the Rolling Stones. They're almost as good as our own Roadrunners." Dick Rowe got up, left the competition, went straight down to London and signed up the Rolling Stones. And they were good friends of the Beatles and often came to Liverpool. I mean, I heard they were in Southport. I got on the phone, I was at the Blue Angel, and phoned Mick Jagger in Southport at his hotel and was just chatting. Said, "Hold on, we'll come and see you." They all got in the van, came down with the musical instruments and got up and did this whole show at the Blue Angel. And when I was down in London in the sort of clubs, particularly at the Revolution, we'd always be with Brian Jones and his sort of girlfriend. It was terrible how he deteriorated. He wanted then to become a member of the Beatles, and he was trying to get in with them. He played on one of the records and that, but he wanted to become a member of the Beatles, and he'd always particularly admired them. And but you could see the deterioration in drugs and his downfall, and he looked terrible, you know. And as far as he was, the allegation that he was murdered, it said that this was due to a contractor who he owed a lot of money to, and that Brian was an excellent swimmer, a very good swimmer, and it unlikely he would have drowned in a swimming pool like that. It was said that this contractor held him down, but it was said to be nothing to do with the Rolling Stones, but to this this chap who he owed a hell of a lot of money for things he structures he did on the house.
Hmm. And his name was Frank Thorogood is the name of the person you're talking about. And it was money. And eyewitnesses come forth saying that they saw him holding under the water. They were threatened not to say anything about it. And I think the tragedy was that when Brian Jones passed away, he had death by misadventure. Some people consider it was suicide. He wasn't able to be buried in the churchyard with his family members. He was buried in a public cemetery.
What about Jimi Hendrix? Did you run into him in the early years in London?
Yes. The very first time he ever appeared, because Chas Chandler was a good friend of mine, and he said, "Come along to," and it was at the Bag of Nail Club where he wanted to show Jimmy to the press. So we're all there, and I always remember Peter Jones, who was editor of the Record Mirror, nearly fainted when Jimmy started playing the guitar with his teeth, you know? And Chas and Jimmy had this flat in by Marble Arch, where me and Virginia used to go with them, and Jimmy used to love playing these board games, especially the ones where you conquer the world, and we used to sit playing these games, and while we were doing it, Jimmy and Chestnut would be smoking pot. Well, pot, I've never smoked pot in my life, but when somebody smokes it, I conk out. It makes me go unconscious. So we were playing the board game, and then the next thing I know, I'd gone asleep, and they'd all had gone off to one of the late night movies and come back, and I just woke up as the return from the late night movies. You know? But you see Jimmy, like, the last time I saw him, it was in New York, and I think it was a club called The Scene. It was great fella, Jimmy, and it was a tragic what happened.
Gary, want to get a quick in here before we start bringing everybody else into the conversation?
Oh, I think the great way to go right now, Ian, is to ask Bill about the white feather, because John had claimed that if he could get a message to Julian from the afterlife, that a white feather hid for it, or try to have a white feather float. And what was interesting, the reason that I know Bill is that I have a partner that I'm working with in some film productions, Ken Hadley, and I believe one of Bill's friends saw him with a white feather around his neck on a necklace. And Bill, you're going to have to fill us in on that.
But... Right, well, you're going to have to do that coming up in just a minute. That's just where we'll leave it, and I can't wait to hear the rest of that story. Then, did John Lennon ever levitate the white feather from the grave? And your phone calls will give you all the numbers. You can join the conversation. It could be about rock and roll mysteries in general with Gary Patterson, or specifically about the Beatles. Here's your chance to put to rest your story about the Beatles, or get it confirmed by Bill Harry next on Coast to Coast AM.